Greetings, cannabis growers of the world. Jordan River here, your personal purveyor of cannabis content. Today we have Stephen Raisner. You guys know and love Steve from the Growing with Fishes podcast, from Kicking Ass in Aquaponics, his APMJ class, and much more. You know him, you love him. It's Steve Raisner, and he's on the show today on the main podcast. So I know you're going to love it. Before we get to it with Steve, got to give some love to jackgreensgardenproducts.com. Use code GCListener, that's GCListener, for big savings. I believe it's 25% right now, across the site, jackgreensgardenproducts.com. Now, they make the Jack's Bug Be Gone, which is my favorite pest spray and veg. It is a pepper ferment. The plants love it, and it knocks the pests absolutely dead. But don't sleep on their soil conditioners. They even have labs ready to go. If you don't want to bother making your own labs with your rice wash and all this nonsense, just hit up jackgreensgardenproducts.com. Get yourself some soil conditioner, some Jack's Bug Be Gone, all natural pest control, and some labs. Completely transform your garden. Use code GCListener. You won't regret it, folks. jackgreensgardenproducts.com. All right, everybody. Let's get into it with Steve. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show. Hello, podcast listeners. You are now listening to GrowCast. I'm your host, Jordan River, and I want to thank you for tuning in today. Before we get started, as always, I urge you to spread the show. Tell a grower about GrowCast. Turn them on to the show. Make sure you're subscribed. Give us a good rating and review. It really helps us out, folks. Thank you. I appreciate it so much. Today we have, it's been a minute. If you've been watching GrowCast TV, you've seen him a couple of times, but it's been a minute since he's been on the main podcast. He's an aquaponics specialist. He's a grow genius. Probably doesn't like me calling him that. Stephen Raisner is on the line from the Growing with Fishes podcast and more. What's up, Steve?
Hey, Jordan. Thanks for having me, man. It's always fun to come on and talk to the people on the GrowCast. You guys have been a big supporters of the show for a long time. We're happy to be back.
Hell yes. Love everything you're doing at Growing with Fishes. Of course, Potent Ponics on Instagram. What have you been up to, man? Talk to me about what's been going on, about your class, about your grow, everything.
Sure. So I've been working on a bunch of stuff. So Marty and I late last year launched the APMJclass.com. You can actually use coupon code GrowCast to get $50 off the class. And it helps both myself and Jordan over there. So definitely check that out if you're looking to save a couple bucks and support two people that you like to get content from at the same time. And we have over a week worth of video content that we're constantly adding new slides to. Marty and I have new slides that we add every month. We also have two live sessions each month, one on Wednesday and one on a Sunday. So that if you have questions, you need instruction on your grow, maybe you're following along with the class while you're growing, we can kind of help you and the rest of the class can learn at the same time. So it's kind of a really cool experience. It's kind of this ever-growing library of content that's kind of a neat, unique experience. We have a whole slide deck that features almost 700 slides now. That is, again, ever growing as people ask us questions. We develop new content around anything that we happen to have gaps in. So it's a really, really cool experience. We also have a nutrient subscription service that we're now managing over 500,000 gallons of commercial aquaponic systems between cannabis and vegetables across North America through APMJnutes.com and trueaquaponics.com, depending on whether or not you're a cannabis or vegetable grower. And if you are a commercial producer, you can go on there and sign up. And we can manage your nutrients remotely as long as you send in your water samples on time and make sure that you're successful.
Jeez,
been what I've been up to. And then as well as working on, I have some cool new projects working on converting pig houses and chicken houses into sustainable aquaponic facilities for both cannabis and vegetable production, which is kind of a cool new project I've been kind of working on this year. There's a lot of those types of properties that are kind of available for sale in the South. And I think it's really a huge opportunity for Southern growers, especially as cannabis becomes more and more online in Southern states. Mississippi's about to come online. Louisiana's coming online soon. Georgia's coming online. So there's a lot of Southern states that traditionally have had a lot of hog and chicken production that can kind of convert, you know, what we generally consider to be, you know, industrial ag practices that I'm sure most of the people that listen to this podcast don't agree with in practice, and convert them into something that is much more sustainable and even producing medicine for people or food for people in a facility that traditionally was, you know, what most people would consider kind of, you know, not beneficial industrial ag. So kind of a very cool project. We're actually taking the facilities that used to have hogs and chickens. We're removing the roof of them and replacing the metal, corrugated metal panels with corrugated plastic panels and turning them into greenhouses. You already have a metal frame that has climate control and is already set up for this. Plus the drains that would normally handle all of the pig or chicken waste that they would normally wash below a grate that would flow down into waste collection tanks, that can be converted into fish tanks once they're fully cleaned and disinfected. They can be completely converted into tilapia tanks. If you go onto my YouTube channel, we actually have some video of some on the project we're currently working on right now, which is just on the border of Arkansas and Oklahoma, which is a really, really cool project. But it allows people to do enormous, almost turnkey operations where all they have to do is run the drain line down to that, you know, waistline, and that returns all the water back to the fish tank. We can run an inline filter in between point A and point B, drop it down into the fish tank once it gets filtered, and then pump that water back up into the head houses in order to, you know, go back to the fish or the plants, I'm sorry, and the grow beds there. So it really makes for a very easily adaptable turnkey kind of setup that's already more or less plumbed for what we need. And, you know, once it's properly disinfected and the roof has been replaced, they make very nice greenhouses as well. So with a little bit of adaptation, it really is kind of a way to convert, you know, kind of what, in my opinion, toxic industrial ag into regenerative ag.
That's incredible, man. So you're refurbing all of these factory farms into aquaponics facilities. That's like that must be a dream come true for you. For the listeners, if you're not familiar with the aquaponic growing style, maybe you're new to the podcast, be sure to go back and listen to the old episode with Steve Reisner, where he goes over it. This basically the idea of raising fish and using the fish and their waste and the fish water to add nutrients to your plants. But Stephen has also talked about the dual root zone, which is something you employ in your grows. You know, your plant's roots aren't just hanging in the water. They sit in a little bit of dirt, and then they kind of, you know, there's a burlap sack or whatever. And, you know, and then they hang down into the water as well. So you get the terrestrial inputs, you get the aquatic inputs, both. I wanted to start there with our exploration today, if you don't mind. There were some questions in the Discord. I was wondering if you could dig into the dual root zone a little bit more for us today, pardon the pun. Why is it necessary? What is it about the terrestrial delivery that you find is necessary? Whether it's the microbes or different nutrients that you might not want the fish necessarily touching, or how does that work and why the dual root zone?
Sure, and that's a really good question. I often get this from aquaponic producers who are like, hey, why do I need to have, you know, any soil at all in my system? You know, this seems kind of outside of what I'm supposed to do for the system structure. And what it comes down to is that if I want the best flavor for the plant, I need to accomplish two things, okay? What determines flavor and flavor expression is terpenes and flavonoids and other defensive mechanisms of the plant. Well, the plant first off needs to have the right nutrients availability in terms of, you know, is the nutrients present in the water or the soil or wherever it is that it's getting nutrients from, regardless of how it is that you want to achieve that.
Okay.
The second thing in that is that you want to be able to activate the plant's immune system. So you have to activate those genes, right? So how do you activate those genes properly without causing a negative impact on plant growth? Well, the best way to do that is by introducing non-pathogenic microbes to the root system. How do you maximize that? You maximize the number of different habitats that the plant's root system has. Mm-hmm. And that's what dual root zone is all about when it comes down to it at the end of the day, is that we have a terrestrial biome and an aquatic biome. And each of them has their own food web that breaks down microbes, breaks down nutrients, and the have separate food webs, you know, be aquatic or terrestrial or fungal or whatever, that breaks down nutrients and incorporates them into a way that is then plant available. And all of them have vastly different chemical processes, but at the end of the day, that's what's important. And by giving the plant access to two different biomes, it can kind of pick and choose what it is that it wants. It's like giving access to someone to a corner store versus a grocery store that has, you know, a whole city block of square footage, right?
Okay.
Obviously, the one that has more options is going to be a healthier person than the person that just has options from the corner store, right? At the end of the day, and we talk about food deserts all the time in other types of agriculture, right? So it's that same type of thing when you have microbial cells. And let's talk about how does this translate into something where, let's talk about, okay, well, he's talking about this and this, but he's just, you know, whatever. How can we extrapolate this into something that's tangible for people that are out there in the real world? Okay, well, where do we see the biggest problems in new hemp fields with fusarium and botrytis? Fields that were corn and soybean and wheat that were poisoned and they used all types of herbicides and glyphosate resistant stuff and all those other things that killed the soil, right? So they had salt minerals and all these different things that would poison the ground, and they have very little microbial response and microbial presence in the soil, so that the plants have no response when they actually are able to develop immune systems. So if I take a cannabis plant and I put it into a sterile field, how is that plant going to be able to defend itself against fungi if it's never seen a fungi in its root system?
Right.
It doesn't know how to defend itself, right? It's the same way that if you don't get any vaccines, whether or not you're for or against vaccines, if you don't have antibodies against a particular microbial pathogen, you're going to get sick if you don't have any ability to defend it against it, right? And by having a non-pathogenic reference point, which there's a ton of data for and white papers for in corn, soybean, wheat, tomatoes, whatever, whatever. And you can look this all up on scholar.google.com on individual beneficial soil microbes activating certain genes that then are also useful for the production of a secondary metabolite that helps defend itself against something like powdery mildew or fusarium or botrytis or whatever, whatever. That's the same reason why you hear people talk about utilizing labs or IMO, is because those are kind of shotgun blasts of different microbes that help stimulate the plant's immune system to kind of wake it up and give it a defense system, right? To have those that it's set of vaccines in order to know what to make defenses against. And at the end of the day, that's what terpenes are, is that terpenes are that defense against environmental factors, right? The plant makes different terpenes or flavonoids or other things in order to defend itself from whatever it is that's out there. So if you don't have those types of things to trigger those genes, the plant's never going to produce those. So you might be able to take that same clone and put it in hydroponics and then in living soil and aquaponics. And the living soil and aquaponics might have much more similar chemovar profiles than the hydroponic plant, because there's nothing to stimulate those genes in that plant. And this has all been proven out in corn, soybean, wheat, and all these other crops, but people don't take that data and then extrapolate it out to cannabis.
Wow.
And when you think about it in that sense, it kind of explains why we see the kind of the advent and the explosion of things like Korean natural farming and Elaine Ingham's teachings and all these other people that are pushing these microbial heavy things. Well, of course, if you combine the published data with their data, this is a no-brainer. It basically one hand explains the other. So you have a lot of people in the organic world that kind of use a hammer to hit a finishing nail, or a sledgehammer to hit a finishing nail. So you have some people that kind of misunderstand how to properly balance organic chemistry. And we have had a couple of people, both in our organic soil and aquaponics, fail for arsenic testing, mainly because of overdoing kelp. Kelp extract, you absolutely can overdo it on if you use too much, if you're fermenting too much of it, or if you're using it, you absolutely can use it safely. If you use it as directed, you will not have problems. But if you go overboard and you try to use it as kind of a lot of people try to use it as a source of potassium, or they'll use it for, some kind of other stuff and end up using it way, way, way overboard. Also, sometimes people will recommend it to kind of stain the water to reduce algae growth. Again, don't use it for that application. You're going to end up way overdosing your system, and then you're going to end up with these long-term bioaccumulation issues. In a hydroponic system, you dump your reservoir on a regular basis. In an aquaponic system, we almost never dump our reservoirs unless something goes catastrophically wrong. We might have a 2 to 5% that will trickle off per month, just to make sure that we're getting some amount of export, usually to a wicking bed outside that we set up with, some type of other, vegetables for the employees, or a public garden, or some kind of other thing to make sure that it's still useful to people. There's nothing wrong with the water. We just want to have some amount of pass through, just to kind of prevent long-term buildup issues. But if you do go overboard with azomite, rock phosphate, seabird guano, or kelp extract, you absolutely can end up with heavy metals issues, and that will bite you in the butt, because the ocean water and the different creatures that, be it kelp or things going down the food chain that the birds eat. Also with seabird guano, you also have a lot of issues with sodium. It tends to be incredibly high in sodium, because where does seabird guano come from? It comes from where the seabirds are regularly roosting, and seabirds, what is their other means of export, right? So seabirds, when they drink seawater, have no way to get rid of sodium. So they shoot it out of their nostrils, believe it or not.
Wow.
So they have the snot that's super high in sodium that then accumulates on top of the seabird guano. So a lot of times people can actually get kind of a sodium burn if they way overdo it with things like seabird guano, trying to boost phosphorus, which I've seen with organic growers, right? Again, it's organic. It can't do any harm, right? It can do harm. You have to actually look at the chemistry of what you're using. It's something that I regularly have to just beat into people's heads with aquaponics. This is just because it says organic on the label doesn't mean that it's safe. You know, arsenic and cyanide are both organic and they'll kill you, right? So you got to be okay. Now, not to say that people that have super high arsenic are going to kill people, but I have seen people fail and been contacted to help fix a grow, actually five now different grows that have had failure for arsenic and then wondering why and then, you know, wow. Call me. So, and that's something you know, is very concerning.
Let me ask, because I know we're going to dig into a second here. We're going to talk about aquaponic friendly nutrients and the lines that you're working with and working on. But if we take a look at, again, back to the nutrients and the fish, is it just about the dosage? Like, what about these micronutrients? I can't imagine they would be beneficial or even, I imagine they would be harmful to the fish. Like, I don't know, like trace minerals like boron and stuff, they can't be good for fish. Is it just a tiny amount in there or, you know what I mean? Or is that more of the terrestrial input?
Yeah. So almost, in fact, all the micronutrient levels that we're running in all of our systems are running optimal plant growth. And I can't think of a single crop that falls outside of this range or are perfectly within what would normally be considered aquaculture safe levels.
Oh, cool.
So wow. They might be higher than or on the upper range of what would normally be considered, you know, fish safe. None of them are outside of that EPA recommended level at all. We don't have a single one. Every once in a blue moon, you might have someone accidentally overdose potassium that gets outside of that range, but never within a lethal level unless they're doing something like salmonids. But even then, there's some science now that you might be able to mitigate some of that issue with the increasing chloride levels. So a lot of people are super terrified of chloride for some reason in the water. But optimal plant growth is 80 to 110 parts per million in an aquatic solution, which is way above what I think most people would say is recommended. But that's the optimal, you know, level with all the different testing that we ever did. And we tested across, you know, 9 to 14 different crops in any one given trot between the greenhouse and the lab that we had. So we were constantly doing tissue analysis through CU and all kinds of fun stuff in order to try to figure out what was there. And in fact, we did a big experiment and we were talking about dual root zone. To circle back to your original question, one of the reasons why we got into it was we were trying to figure out, okay, well, what is different in the tissue between an aquaponic grown plant in a media bed, a DWC, and a soil grown plant? Right before we got into dual root zone. So we tested it. And what were the two nutrients that were different? Chloride and silica. Those are the only two that had any significant outside of statistical error in terms of PPM concentration. So we went and adjusted that in the aquaponic solution. And as soon as we switched to potassium silicate over potassium hydroxide or carbonate in our aquaponic solutions for our pH up solution, it ended up immediately solving our a lot of our mold issues and things like that. The plants had a better defense system and the plants just were more robust. They were more heat resistant. Lettuce bolts less often.
Wow.
By adding silica. What else? They freeze less as well. So if you have a super cold temperature, the plant tissue tends to survive a little more readily in ultra cold temperatures for vegetables. We've noticed that with a couple of customers that we work with through True Aquaponics that have survived, especially this last big hard freeze in Texas. A lot of them, you know, survived. The people using potassium silicate, their lettuce survived, and the people that weren't didn't because that silica helped the plants produce a little extra sugars and a little extra, you know, defense mechanisms against that frost. And a couple of other cool things, heat resistance as well. We've noticed quite a big difference in bolting times in high heat DWC settings with lettuces with the higher silica, and then powdery mildew resistances across the board, regardless of crop.
Damn, man, that is fascinating. We'll be right back with Steve in a moment, but before that, shout out to Plant Success. Plant Success, the makers of the Plant Revolution line. You've seen their Great White Myco. You've seen their King Crab beneficial bacteria? Oh yeah, baby, go and give it a try. You can find them at plant-success.com. Find them in your local hydro store, and you will not regret incorporating these products into your grow. I love the King Crab beneficial bacteria. It's a really nice microbial product because so many other microbial products come loaded with a bunch of other stuff that you may not want to be doubling up on for redundancies for whatever reason. So just the concentrated, highly concentrated beneficial bacteria that's in King Crab, it's a really good tool to have in your garden when you just want to boost that beneficial bacterial life and nothing else. Useful in grows like DWC setups, I've heard, hydro setups, because again, it doesn't come with all that extra funk in it. Just the clean, highly concentrated microbes. Of course, check out their liquid orca, liquid mycorrhiza, their granular great white, their mycochum, and much more. Plant success, baby, aka plant revolution. Find great white, king crab, and everything that they offer in your local hydro store. Tell them Growcast sent you. All right, everybody. Let's get back to it with Stephen Reisner. So as hungry as cannabis is, and it sounds like you do need to dial it in specifically for this aquaponics system, but it is in balance. There's nothing out of range, and it is a natural, fish-safe, and sustainable system. I love aquaponics, learning about it. I wish I could do it myself. I will do it myself one day, my friend. I want to get your take on a couple of things here. One thing that you brought up on Growcast TV for the members over at patreon.com/growcast, you did a couple great episodes, but one of the points you brought up really stuck with me. You were talking about the production of anthocyanins in cannabis, and you know, these are the flavonoids that we're very, very concerned with if we like purple weed. You know, this is what makes broccoli purple. It brings out lots of beautiful colors in cannabis. You pointed out that anthocyanin production was reliant upon molybdenum. And I had never heard that before. Can you talk about that and kind of recap that here on the main podcast for us?
Sure. So for those of you that don't know, molybdenum is very important for processing nitrate back to ammonia for plants. So it's very important for aquaponic systems because that is a process that is much more heavily taking place than in a soil environment where most of your nitrogen's in an ammonia form. So you have to have that in order to help the plants have an easier time converting it and not have kind of a choke point there. If you have super low molybdenum, the plants can also use melinium as a last resort for that chemical process, but it's not very good if you can help it in cannabis at least. So one of the other things that molybdenum is also heavily used for is the production of anthocyanin. That's one of the main things that the plant needs in order to produce that compound. So by boosting your molybdenum levels and giving them a very mild molybdenum toxicity, the plant will actually produce extra anthocyanin to help bind up that molybdenum and basically become additionally more darker purple than it normally would express itself, as long as you don't completely overshoot it. But we found between 0.2 and 0.4 ppms of molybdenum is perfectly fine. We've even run them as high as 1 ppm molybdenum and had no real negative impact on growth that we could detect. And have significantly more purple plants. So I highly, highly recommend adding some sodium molybdenate, especially, you know, 2 or 3 weeks before you go into flower, you know, or, you know, right at transition at the very least, to try and help boost that expression at that point in growth. It'll very much help with your purples. And that's something that if you're looking for sales appeal for resale, that is the single best thing that you can do for your grow. If you have a indica cut that's already susceptible and predisposed to producing those purple colors, it will help boost that. But also, purple strains are what flies off the shelf. You can't go to a dispensary in Oklahoma and have any purple cut sit there for more than 72 to 96 hours. It'll just be gone. And it just flies off the shelf. We went to a place the other day that had like 100 and 150 different strains, something crazy. Not one was purple. All of them had sold, right? Yeah. So if you want stuff that's going to move, grow purple.
People love purple weed, man. So as far as the molybdenum, what common or, you know, kind of available inputs are high in molybdenum? Like a single source or as close as you can?
So the two ones, or the main one I would recommend is sodium molybdenate. That's the easiest and cheapest one to get. You could order $10 to $20 bag of sodium molybdenate, and it'll last you probably the rest of your lifetime. The other option you can do is ammonium orthomolybdenate, which is not as cheap and tends to be a little bit more of a pain in the ass to dose, especially on smaller systems or fewer plants. If you're doing a larger scale operation, it tends to be a little bit better, but it can be kind of a pain in the ass to work with. And just, I don't know. It's not my first go-to. I think sodium aluminate, you're not adding that much sodium. You're talking about, you know, 0.1, 0.2 ppms. It's nothing that's going to have any type of plant impact.
Man, interesting stuff. Are there any other really important kind of relationships between maybe some of these compounds that are so desirable to us and, you know, these more what I would consider obscure micronutrients?
So I think the biggest one I would say is silica, making sure you have bioavailable silica, especially if you're dealing with aquatic solutions and not with terrestrial solutions. In a terrestrial environment, silica is usually pretty well available. Regardless of what type of soil mix you have, most of them are pretty decent in that. And then the other big one would be manganese. Manganese is very important for THC expression. If you're really trying to, you know, ultra slam those, make sure that you're on the upper end of what you're supposed to have for manganese. You know, most of the time we're aiming for a, 0.2 to 0.5 parts per million manganese. You can go a little bit higher than that in an aquatic solution. But, you know, that would definitely be something that can hamstring you if your manganese is super low. It absolutely will help reduce the total expression of THC versus having that elevated. That is something that definitely does make a difference.
Okay, absolutely. The manganese and the silica. What are your thoughts on the silicic acid products? You know, this Power SI is blowing up. Is that something that you're interested in incorporating into your grow or experimenting with?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something I would be interested in working with. With aquaponics, though, we have to boost our pH pretty regularly. So alternating potassium silicate and calcium carbonate, I can kind of handle both of those nutrients pretty passively. So I don't really have to go and, you know, go out of my way to dose those because they're part of my normal pH maintenance anyway.
I see.
So we try to kind of pre-bake as much of our stuff into the systems as possible. We also have some pretty easy to use kits for micronutrients. If you don't want to have to deal with dialing all this stuff in, we have a kit that, you know, gets you one third of the way there. As long as you have some remote idea on it, you can either just use three of them to get all the way there, or you can use one of them to kind of boost it if you think something's low, or two of them if you need to. You know, it kind of gives you that ability to not overshoot it, or, you know, just give a little bit of a boost depending on what you want, and without, you know, completely falling into a range where you're going to hurt anything. So that's kind of what those are designed for in an aquatic solution or even hydroponics. The micronutrients are you know, almost the same. A little bit of adjustments, a little bit higher manganese and molybdenum, but for the most part, not a huge, huge difference. A little bit of a balance, more of a balance in terms of ratios than anything else.
I see. So now that we're here, why don't we dig into it? Talk to me about your aquaponics nutrient line, the different ones you're working with, people you're working with, everything.
Sure. So I work with a gentleman and called Roger over at True Aquaponics, and we've been working on a bunch of different aquaponic stuff. We work together with commercial aquaponic facilities, so we have a lot of data on exact parts per million of all different types of crops across a wide range of different size facilities and systems, which gives us a huge advantage in terms of dialing and nutrient dosing and specific dosing per week and all that kind of stuff. As long as we know what crops you have roughly and what your base pH is, we can give you a really good formulation around that. So basically, you can go to apmjnutes.com and you can check that out, and you can order how many weeks of veg, how many weeks of flower based on the cultivars that you're growing, and you just kind of adjust, add that once a week to your system, and that boosts the nutrients in order to help, you know, your cannabis or vegetables, depending on what kit that you buy, grow each week. So this way you don't have to worry about keeping everything balanced. It kind of adjusts for how much those plants are uptaking on a given week. If you think that the plants are kind of doing pretty well, maybe, you know, skip that week. It's perfectly fine. It's kind of, allows you to kind of have anywhere from 1 to 3 doses per month and kind of give you a little bit of an adjustment and not be able to be kind of hard to overdose accidentally is also kind of pre-baked into it. But also just trying to make sure that a lot of the stuff, you know, fish waste wasn't designed to grow cannabis. It wasn't designed to grow lettuce. You know, fish waste is fish waste, the same way that our waste is our waste, right? So you have to do some minor adjustments in order to make plants grow, in order to make sure they get optimal growth rates. There's a lot of mythology around aquaponics that says that, you know, fish poops got what plants crave, right? Like, it's not Brando, right? Like fish poop is not Brando.
Shout out to Mike Judge.
That's something that just frustrates me. And you have people that are trying to engineer fish food that will do that. And we worked really hard at the aquaponic source with a company and some kids at a college that I'm not going to get into details on because I don't know if I'm NDA'd still on that or not. But I can at least say this, that we worked pretty hard with a college that, and ABC Organics, which is a company that the owner ended up passing away while we were working with them on the project. But we were not able to get the minerals high enough without oxidation occurring while going through the fish for things like iron and some other things and breaking chelation. And then having any type of control over the nutrient level, especially if it kind of really screwed up our mineralization tables and everything else. And it just got really complicated. So it wasn't something that we felt we were able to do across any fish species either. There was some issues with particular fish species and certain nutrients, and it just turned into this really complicated problem that just, to me, seems like totally crazy to try and address in that manner. I think you're far better off just taking, you know, whatever base that you have from whatever fish species that you find is going to work well monetarily for your farm, and then just adjusting it back into range based on what you're missing, right? I think that's a much more economical way. I can take that and apply it to any farm in the world. I can take it to any freshwater fish species just about and make it work, right? No matter what crop you throw at me. At the end of the day, that's what we need to get to if we're going to make this commercially viable as the next thing for agriculture, especially in nation. You know, water is becoming more and more scarce. Mm-hmm. This allows us to use 90% less water for cannabis, on average 82% less water per run, just because they tend to use a lot of water for their cultivation in particular. So it's a little bit more than lettuce, at least in my math and in all of my actual data versus, you know, a lot of stuff out there. I think that there's some of the numbers that have been put out there about aquaponics are a little bit, you know, I wouldn't believe anyone that tells you 95%, that there's no data to back that up.
Still though, man.
Either way, it's a lot less than soil. And there's a lot of places that are reducing their water tables. We got to get on to stuff that's recapturing water, or we're not going to have water in 20 years, yeah. Right? Like, there's just a lot of these types of places in Barbados and Jamaica and Trinidad, right? They don't have water. They don't have a ground table for it to go back into, right? It just goes back to the ocean. So you have to have as much capture as you can.
Jeez.
Not to mention it's a backup water source, right? If there is an emergency, you can filter and drink that water, right? So it also works in places like California, right? If there's a wildfire coming, pump out my DWC beds, man. Save the hill, right? Like, it's fine. Right. No, but seriously, I've seen that happen with aquaponic facilities, and it can be these emergency community things that, look, it ain't great for your lettuce production, but you know what? Everyone's going to buy lettuce from you when this is all over.
Wow,
you know, and there's these things where you kind of can be that last resort of fresh water for a community in those types of extreme situations. And they often are happening in California right now. So, you know, it just gives you an example of where these farms can kind of be additionally beneficial to the communities because of the large reservoirs they end up kind of being just to exist.
That is fascinating stuff, man. The hidden applications of the aquaponics culture.
You also have counties like Humboldt County in California that have very high restrictions on the amount of water you're allowed to use per plant per day, right? So if I want to hit those, I need to utilize some type of water recapture in order to be able to, you know, meet the guidelines I have just to have my license, right? So this is something I think is going to be more and more and more common across the West as the cannabis industry matures. And I think it's also going to be further applied to additional ag. I mean, you're already seeing some of the cannabis laws applying just to vegetable growers from aquaponics that are being forced to use light depth because they don't want to see the lights because they think it's cannabis, even though it's just some poor lettuce grower that's now having to put up $40,000 for a light depth system because the neighbors are growing weed. And I've seen that happen too.
Man, that is fucking crazy. Man, what you do is so unique. That's one of the reasons I really like speaking to you is it's unlike the vast majority of my guests. I want to circle back though on something you said, because I want to make sure we got time for this. We are up against it today. You talked about, you know, this is important for me to have a system that's applicable to anyone in a different part of the world with a little bit of a different water source, different freshwater fish, you said. Can we end this subject on fish? Can we end this podcast on the subject of fish? And talk to me about what fish are good, why the selection of the fish are important, which fish are bad. Like, talk to me about weed and fish.
Sure. So in general, commercially, for what we recommend for commercial farms is to start off with koi. Koi have the best return on investment in terms of investment on an individual fish, and then the return that you get. Butterfly koi, for instance, you know, can cost you $1 to $3 a piece. Once you sell them, can get anywhere from 18 to, you know, $60 a piece, sometimes even more, after 1 to 2 years, right? So your return on that is much greater than a tilapia, which is going to be a $4 to $6 fillet, right? It's not that much. So if you're going to donate and work with a church group or a, you know, some other humanitarian group that wants to donate the fish and provide it for the local community, then that's fine. Go with tilapia. They're just as bulletproof. But if your goal is monetization, then to go with koi. And if you don't have either one of those in your local area, in South America, pacu are a really, really good one. And then if you're somewhere else, you know, anything that's going to be able to survive, you know, a lower oxygen environment, just in case you do have an emergency, is always good. And then something that's going to be able to grow pretty rapidly without, you know, really beating on each other a lot. If you do have a species that is pretty aggressive, bluegill, perch, other things like that tend to be a little bit more aggressive towards each other. Dosing with things like labs or lactobacillus from Korean Natural Farming greatly helps reduce infection in the fish, as well as increase plant growth rate and reduce pathogens in the system. So that can be a great way to help reduce some of the issues that come along with more aggressive freshwater fish. But those tend to be the biggest ones. I also worked with a guy in India for a little while breeding snakeheads in order for resale into the aquaculture trade over there in India. But that was kind of a weird one-off thing. But they're also super hardy. If you are in an area of the world where they are legal, they are illegal in the United States. But if you are in an area where they are legal, they are probably the single fastest growing fish that you can grow. Pacu probably being second for a food fish.
That's insane. Any fish that is like, you cannot use them for whatever reason.
Mainly just them. In fact, I know people that are doing sturgeon and then selling the caviar. There's a group that I was working with and I have done some quotes with that may or may not see the light of day here in Oklahoma, that depending on whether or not everything comes together, we'll be doing that. And then there's a couple of other groups too that I know. A friend of mine, Joe, has been working on some stuff with sturgeon and some other weird stuff. I know there's another group too that was just crossbreeding sturgeon and shovelnose spoonbills. Spoonbills and sturgeon, which is super strange. I guess it was some kind of accident that they did at their breeding facility, and now they're doing it intentionally. Wow. And they kind of got three different phenos out of it, where the different different combinations of the genetics seem to fall into like three or four different combos that worked in order to have viable young, and they have very distinctly different morphology, which is kind of neat to see in fish if you're a fish nerd. But jeez, you can look that up online.
That's fascinating stuff, man. What about goldfish? Why not just get a bunch of goldfish?
Absolutely can get a bunch of goldfish. If you are going to get a bunch of goldfish from the store, feeder fish or whatever, and you're really just trying to shoestring it, the thing I'd recommend is take 1 pound of aquarium salt or sea salt, put it in a 5-gallon bucket, and make sure you take all the goldfish that you have and dip them in there for 30 seconds to 90 seconds before you put them into the system that you're going to put them into, just to kill any ick or any external parasites, because feeder fish tend to be pretty parasitic. So you want to definitely, like, at the very least, give them a salt dip or something else to kill whatever's physically on them to make sure that you're not introducing it into your system.
Interesting stuff.
The other
man.
Thing that works really well for that, and this is going to sound really cool for the people that are more, you know, into the more well-traveled ethogens, is betel nut extract, the same stuff that the Southeast Asian guys stain their teeth with and get super high on. They actually use that for treating nematodes and planarians in aquatic systems as well. You can actually use that for make a tea out of it and use it for treating nematodes in your soil. If you get like not nematodes and you know, bad plant nematodes, it's one of the few things you can use that won't wipe out the rest of your soil food web.
Betel nut extract, whoa.
It's so safe that you can use it with shrimp, just to give you an idea of when used as directed. It's very gentle, unless you're a nematode or a planarian or a slug or a snail.
Interesting, man. Super interesting. God, you're full of them, man. You're absolutely full of them. Steve, thank you so much for doing this show today, man. This was, as usual, an enlightening and very unique episode. I appreciate you, man.
Sure. Yeah, man. Thanks. Anytime. And always happy to have you on our show as well. And, yeah, thanks again. And you can catch me at Growing with Fishes on all your favorite podcast apps, SoundCloud, iTunes, Spotify, all the things. APMJclass.com, APMJnewts.com. Remember, coupon code GROWCAST.
Yeah, buddy.
I can't talk today.
I appreciate
in order to
that.
Get $50 off on the class.
We'd love to come back on your show anytime, man. It is a pleasure. We'll have you back on GrowCast TV. Good luck with everything you're doing down there in Oklahoma with your class, with the newts, apnewts.com. What was the vegetable one again? I'm sorry. TrueAquaponicsNutrients.com. Is that it?
Yeah. TrueAquaponics.com.
TrueAquaponics.com. Okay. There you go. TrueAquaponics.com, everybody. Oh, that's all. Make sure to give them a follow at PotentPonics on Instagram. Give us a follow at GrowCast. This is Steve Raisner and Jordan River signing off. Wishing you an extraordinary day, everybody. Be safe out there and grow smarter. That's our show for today, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in. And thank you to Steve for dropping by. Before we wrap the show, Migro, baby, we got like 3 days left. You need some highly efficient home grow LED lights? MigroLight.com, MigroLight.com. Use code GROWCAST for 5% off the Migro arrays, the already affordable Migro arrays. And this is the only code on the net, folks, and it ends in just a few days. So if you're looking to upgrade, get yourself some arrays, get yourself some UV boosters, MigroLight is where you need to go. MigroLight.com, code GROWCAST. The arrays are customizable and modular, and they are sexy looking. Use this code before it's up. You don't want to miss out. MigroLight.com, code GROWCAST. Active for a few days now, until the 1st of June. Thank you so much, everybody. Shout out to IllinoisCannaConsulting.com, richest consulting company. Shout out to Jay Blank on SoundCloud for doing the ad beat. And shout out to all the lovely members, Patreon.com/GrowCast. You know who you are. And of course, all you listeners. Could not do it without each and every one of you. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time on GrowCast.